I read yesterday that the purpose of the retreat is to evoke the life and teachings of Sangharakshita and his special connection with Guru Padmasambhava. So I'm going to do that this morning. At least I'm going to contribute to the theme, and I hope you find it interesting and worthwhile. So what I'm going to speak about is roughly the first 10 years or so of the movement, from the late 1960s to the early 1970s. I expect that there are quite a few of you here who were perhaps even infants at the time, or I was going to say certainly in short trousers, but that's a bit old-fashioned, isn't it? But it's going back almost 50 years, and that's a good chunk of time. It's not an era, it's not an eon, but it's a respectable small piece of history. I'm going to do some reminiscing, inevitably. I bumped into Satya Raja last Saturday in Norwich, and he said, "Oh, you're going to Padmaloka, you know, to give a talk." He said, "You're going to be reminiscing about Bhante, full stop." And I said, "Yeah, that's true. I'm going to be reminiscing about Bhante, but I'm also going to be trying to put it into some kind of context. So I'm going to try and place what I've got to say in the context of the contemporary culture at the time, which is relevant, and also in the context of my own spiritual development. I first came along, as they say, in 1967, the summer of 1967, when the movement had been in existence only 4 months. And my first contact was on a summer retreat. In fact, the very first retreat that Bhante ever led. And there was a young man there called Stephen Parr, who a year later became one of the first order members. And he is now called Ananda. And he was in the first batch of 12. So when I first came along, there was no order. There were just a handful of people who were friends of Bhante. So I do speak about this subject quite a bit, especially over the last few years for some reason. People in one context or another have asked me to speak about this time of my life and this time of the movement. And I like to do this, but I think it's also very important for all of us. It's very important for all of us here to know something about our own spiritual roots, how the movement that we're getting so involved in is so important, the roots of that, how it all started, why Bhante started it and what happened. It's very, very important to be able to do this. So I'm going to, there'll be a little bit of a prologue, and then I'm going to talk about the zeitgeist. I like big words sometimes. Zeitgeist means the spirit of the times. I'm going to talk a bit about that. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about the merging of two streams. The two streams being my own stream of spiritual development and Bhante's and the movement at the time. And then I'm going to say a little bit about the Urgyen factor, because this is the Urgyen retreat. Then a little bit about mindfulness, and then a section on spiritual friendship, and then conclude. So if I can fit all that in, we're going to be here till lunchtime, so I hope you don't mind. So a little prelude first. I'm going to go back to 1969, the spring of 1969. And I was staying with Bhante in his flat in Highgate West Hill in London, quite near Hampstead. He had quite a pleasant flat, which he shared with his friend, Terry de la Mer. And I was staying there for a few days, and Bhante was quite busy, on and off. And one morning I had occasion to go into his room and to ask him something. And he was pacing up and down the room with his mala in his hand, dressed in his robes. He was always in his robes in those days. Mala in his hand, and then he would stop at his desk at the end of the room and write a note. And what he was doing, he was preparing a lecture. And that lecture was breaking through into Buddhahood. And I expect that he was also at the time reciting the Manju Gosha mantra. I don't know this for certain, of course, but he said on a later occasion that when he was preparing talks, when he was writing, and especially if he got stuck, if he got really stuck, he would do the Manju Gosha Stuti Sadhana, which he introduced to us later, a couple of years later, early in my order life. And if he wasn't doing the Stuti Sadhana, I expect that at such times of preparation, he was reciting the Manju Gosha mantra. Who is Manju Gosha? Is, of course, the Lord of Speech, the Lord of Eloquence, and he's very much helpful in situations where you're trying to work out what to say. And at the beginning of that talk, Breaking Through into Buddhahood, he said that this day, the day he gave the talk, was the second anniversary of the founding of the movement, 1969. And what an important event that was. He didn't say in the history of Buddhism, but I would like to add that I think it was a very significant event in the history of Buddhism in the UK, even in Europe. And his theme was breaking through, bursting out, getting out of one's bonds, escaping from the bonds that trammel us, that keep us constricted, that prevent us from growing and developing. And it was a very radical talk, very inspiring and radical talk. And he said that there are four things we need to break through. I'm not going to go into any detail of these, but it's well worth listening to this lecture. And the four things you have to break through are negative emotion, psychological conditioning, rational thinking, and finally, clock time. I'm going to come back to the last one later on in my talk. So just a little bit about the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age, in relation to breaking through. The 1960s, the late 1960s and the early 1970s, the culture at that time was conducive to breakthrough. It was conducive to breaking out of molds of whatever kind, not just in the area of spiritual development, but in all sorts of ways. the mid-60s became known as the permissive society. And all sorts of conventions were breaking down. For example, homosexual acts between consenting adults over the age of 18, I believe, it may have been 21, were made legal in 1967. Before that, it was illegal. So that was quite a breakthrough of its time. Kenneth Tynan, a famous literary critic, said the dreaded F word on television one evening, and everybody was breakthrough. We let our hair down, literally speaking. I got hair to let down in those days. We grew our hair long. Lots of people grew our hair long. And Bante himself, he grew his hair quite long against all, certainly Theravada Buddhist conventions. And he grew long, what we call mutton chops, mutton chop whiskers down here. So he had this long sort of flowing hair to his shoulders, mutton chop whiskers. He wore lots of rings on his fingers. And he experimented, not so much as us, but he experimented to some degree with mind-altering drugs. And there were people dropping out right, left and centre. You know, it became the fashion with young people to drop out. And I remember one retreat in the early 1970s, Bante told me that at the end of the retreat, there was a queue of people, must have been about 20 people, waiting outside to speak to him at the end of the retreat. And he said 90% of those people were suggesting to him that it was time that they dropped out, trying to persuade him that it was a good thing, spiritually speaking, for them to drop out. And it was the 1965 was the year of Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. And we called each other ma'am. Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am. Rubbish, ma'am. You're talking rubbish, ma'am. I don't know what the women said, but all the men said ma'am. So why I've included all that is that it was all very conducive to Bante's spiritual project. It made, in a way, it made the passage easier than otherwise it would have been. Okay, now I'm going to say a little bit about the merging of the two streams. The merging of the two streams being, first of all, my own modest little trickle compared with Bante's full flow. Yeah? I experienced the merging of these two streams in my contact with him in the early days. And up to the spring of 1967, I was living in Bangkok, and I was teaching English in Bangkok. And it was in Bangkok that, at that time, that I first experienced the impact of the Dharma. And when one first experiences the impact of the Dharma, that is a very, very deep and moving experience. And this contact came in the form of a text, a Dzogchen, a Tibetan Dzogchen text. And a friend of mine, one evening, he had this text in his hand and he was reading it. And I confess that we were all lying on the floor, stoned out of our minds, But never mind. We were listening. And the words of this text were coming through to us. And at the time, I was quite, on the surface at least, I was quite sceptical about the words. I was even, you could say, a bit cynical. I had escaped from Christianity. I had no religion at all. And my stance was that I wasn't interested in religion and spiritual matters. So when he'd read it, I sort of lightly began to argue with him and say that, there wasn't much in it. But the interesting thing was that a few days later, I found myself in the bookshop buying the book. And it was a beautiful, hard-backed edition with illustrations, coloured illustrations, with tissue paper over each illustration. Do you remember that? It was really, really beautiful. And the typeface was fantastic. And the pages were thick. And the type was black. And important passages, sometimes titles, were in red. It was a very impressive experience. So what I'm saying is that the Dharma, even though I'd heard it superficially in my head, was saying no, my heart was saying yes, yes, yes. So I got back to England, and I said to my wife, I was married at the time, I said, we must find a Buddhist group. We've got to find a group of people who are, practicing Buddhism. So we came across an advert in the New Statesman, a little box advertisement, which said, Buddhist retreat in Hazelmere, Surrey. Friends of the Western Sangha. Food, vegetarian. We thought that was a bit cranky. But we said, never mind, let's go along. So I went along, and I met Dante in the vestibule of the retreat house, where he was standing, shaking hands with the retreatants as they arrived. And I refer you to get a picture of what Dante was like. I refer you to a photograph which is in the lounge on the, what I'll call the garden wall. There's a photograph of Dante standing sideways to a shrine in his robes, dark hair, black-rimmed glasses. This is what he looked like. I thought that this morning as I looked at the picture. This is what he looked like when I first met him in that little vestibule in 1967. So this was my second impact of the Dharma. So, first of all, the book, as I've told you, that was quite something. But then to meet someone in the flesh who had realized the Dharma to the extent that Bhante had, that was quite another thing. That was really a very powerful experience for me. And in those days, there was something quite magical about Bhante's presence. I'm not saying there isn't these days, but in those days, and perhaps because of the way I was at the time, projecting perhaps quite a bit, there was something quite magical. He just got back from India, from 20 years in India. He was very dark-skinned, and it was difficult to say whether he was Indian or English. Anyway, it was a very fortunate coincidence, as I see it, that my introduction to the Dharma coincided with Bhante's founding of the Friends of the Western Sangha, as it was, for a few months, and later became the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, and then eventually, as we know it, the Tri Ratna Buddhist community. I do want to say a little bit about the Urgian connection. And this is quite personal, but I think it's relevant. As I left Bangkok, I went on my way back to UK. I went to Kathmandu. And Kathmandu is, even in those days, was a very good place to buy Buddha rupas, Buddha statues. And I was after just a Buddha head. You know those brass Buddha heads? Small, big. I wanted one of those. And I'd been to Calcutta and I'd looked at the marketplaces in Calcutta. I just couldn't find what I wanted. And there I was in Kathmandu, and in the foyer of the hotel I was staying at, the Snow View Hotel, there was this boy. I don't know whether he was Tibetan or Nepalese, but he had a little stall and he had knickknacks and he had a few sort of statues. And every morning when I went down, as I was going out, he's a really nice guy, he said, "You want to buy the Buddha?" He pointed to this statue. I said, "No, I don't want that." I said, I told him what I was looking for. He hadn't got one. Anyway, I couldn't find one in Kathmandu. And on the last morning, I was sort of hurrying down to get to the airport. And he said, you want Buddhist? I said, okay. So I bought this rupa, this silver-coloured rupa of this man with a funny hat on and long robes and holding some funny things in his hands. And I felt dissatisfied in a way because it wasn't what I wanted. But I bought it. And I didn't haggle with him because I wanted to catch the plane. I just paid the money and took it. Anyway, I'll tell you this little story because late 1967, Bhante came to visit me and my wife. We were living in Bournemouth. And, of course, I showed him this statue. I said, "Look, this is what I bought in Kathmandu." He picked it up and he said, "Oh, good," he said, "it's Padmasambhava." And I said, Who's Padmasambhava? And he shook it. He said, "Oh, good, it's been, what do you call it, sacralized?" Whatever. It got a sort of mantra in a little roll inside it. So it was the genuine thing. The only thing that was missing, and I'm afraid I never replaced it, was the Katvanga. I could easily have got someone to make a Katvanga, but I didn't. Anyway, I didn't know at the time, but the text that I've been talking about, the frontispiece, the front picture with the tissue over it, was a picture of Padmasambhava. I'd seen it several times and hadn't made any contact. And suddenly there was this connection between the text I'd read and had really made an impression on me and this rupa that I bought, confirmed by Bhante as being a very significant rupa. There's connection there. So this is my first, as it were, Urgyen contact, because Urgyen is one of the names of Padmasambhava, and Urgyen is the name which Sangrakshita took several years later. Well, he didn't take it several years later. He had it. I think the name was given to him by Khatchu Rinpoche, but he never used it until, I'm sure, either the late 80s or the early 90s, and I don't know why he decided to point that out at that time. Before I leave this Urgyen connection, I want to mention Vajrasattva, because Vajrasattva is also a very important figure for me and has been very influential in my own spiritual development. I'm just trying to decide which little which little bit to say first. Anyway, on that first retreat, Bhante was extremely friendly, and we had some very good chats, and I used to find myself making a beeline to wherever he was so that I could talk to him. And we were standing after supper one evening with cups of tea, and he told me that famous story, which you all must have heard, about the man in the pit. Yeah? You know this. Anyway, he said he'd just come back from India and one night. If you want to read this story, I refer you to Moving Against the Stream, which is the latest in Bhante's memoirs. And he tells the story very movingly and very dramatically in that book. Anyway, we're standing there with our cups of tea, and Bhante tells me this story of the man in the pit. This pit opens by, he wakes up in the middle of the night and the pit opens by the side of his bed, and there's this man whom he used to know in Kalimpong with joined hands at the bottom of the pit, imploring, needing to be rescued. And Bhante realised that it was very urgent and he must do something, and he couldn't think immediately of what to do. Then there came to him Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche, saying to him one day that he'd just come back from a lama's funeral, and he'd been reciting the Vajrasattva mantra. He said to Bhante, because Vajrasattva is the deliverer from hell. Yeah. So this came to Bhante's mind, and he started reciting the mantra, and the letters of the mantra came out of his mouth in presumably little white tablet-shaped forms and formed a mala. And the figure at the bottom hoisted himself up on this chain of the mala. And he said, then Bhante said, disappeared. Oh, yes. Has another drink of his tea. I was absolutely astounded. I mean, it's just the casual way he said it. He didn't say, oh, I had this fantastic spiritual experience. Or it was quite sort of, you know, just a little story. And I don't know why he said it, but it made a very big impression on me. Anyway, winding fast forward to my ordination in 1974, I remember my private ordination very well, actually. Certain bits of it, anyway. And I remember entering the shrine room and Bhante at the end, sitting by the shrine, holding up a long-stalked lily. And lily, I believe, in other conventions, is a symbol of purity, a symbol of purification. Anyway, when it came to the time where I had to decide which practice I wanted, I was a bit torn. I was torn between Uyghur, although I didn't know that was his name at the time, I was torn between Padmasambhava and Vajrasattva. And I mentioned Padmasambhava first, and then Vajrasattva. And Bhante said, ah, yes, Vajrasattva, he said, that rings a bell, doesn't it? yes, Bhante. and he gave me the Vajrasattva mantra. And I recited the mantra three times after him, chanted it in the shrine room. And he said, I want you to visualize the blue Vajrasattva. So I did. I did that practice a lot in the first few years of being an order member. But this practice, I didn't know all that much about it until 2001 or 2002, when I went to live in Birmingham. And then I said to Bhante, I want to know more about this practice. You know, who gave it to you? And he said it was Dujom Rinpoche. And it turned out that Bhante gave me the text of the sadhana in his own handwriting. And why I tell you the story is the title of the text is, the title of the sadhana is The Confounder of Hell. Yes. Or in Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche's words, the deliverer from hell. And that really rang a bell for me. You know, in some sense, I wanted to be delivered from hell. We all do. We all want to be delivered from our suffering. But that was very strong in me. And looking back, linking the two events, you know, he said, that rings a bell, doesn't it? It was the need to be purified of all one's stuff, you know, especially in terms of breaking through one's psychological conditioning, which he mentioned in the Breaking Through into Buddhahood lecture. So why am I telling you all this? Well, I'm telling you all this because I find it interesting and I hope you find it interesting. But I'm also telling it to you because I had this strange sense of time not being linear. Clock time is linear. First it's 1 o'clock, then it's 2 o'clock. First it's Monday, then it's Tuesday, and so on. But actually, time is weird. Time is very strange. And the present sometimes prefigures the future. And it all gets sort of, I'm not expressing this very articulately, but it all gets sort of mixed up. The English poet T.S. Eliot puts it very well. He expresses in a nutshell what I'm trying to say. He says, time present, this is at the beginning of a poem called The Four Quartets. Time present and time past are both present in time future, and time future contained in time past. What might have been and what has been point to one end, which is always present. So the last 2 or 3 weeks, when I've been thinking about what to say today, I've had this very, very strong sense of time being like the present prefiguring the future, and then the future going back to the past, and all relating up together and making sense. So in a way, I've felt over the last few days, this has made much better sense to me. These connections that I've mentioned, they make much better sense to me than they did when they happened at the time, sequentially, linearly. I'm not happy where I've expressed that, but I think it's something that's beyond rational thinking. And rational thinking is another of those aspects that Bhante says in the lecture that we have to break through. Breaking through clock time into what he calls organic time. And organic time is pure duration. I didn't want to let this occasion go by without taking the opportunity to talk about Bhante and mindfulness. Going back to that 1967 retreat, the first thing he did was to get us all together into, I won't call it the shrine room, it wasn't a shrine room in those days, but it was the assembly room with a stage at the end, and Bhante sat on the stage, and the rest of us in the congregation, so to speak, with a few weirdos sitting cross-legged at the front, the rest of us on upright chairs. And he said, we're going to do meditation. I'm going to introduce you to this practice, the mindfulness of breathing. And he introduced us to the practice in his beautiful, measured, calm, clear way. And we did the practice. I did the practice. And it was wonderful. It was technically so simple. And even at that time, it was practically, experientially, quite straightforward. So I had no expectations at all. So I got quite concentrated within a few minutes. And I experienced what's called in Zen tradition, beginner's mind. And that was a really powerful experience. And it was really enjoyable. So in terms of what I learned later, this was a glimpse, at least a first glimpse, of the first stages of the spiral path. My life had been unsatisfactory to some extent. Then I came across Bhante, the Dharma, and the movement. And so in terms, independence on suffering, or independence on unsatisfactoriness, there arose faith. I listened to the Dharma, I have faith in the Dharma, and then I'm introduced to the practice of the Dharma in the form of the mindfulness of breathing, and I have a very fulfilling, enjoyable experience. So, independence upon faith arises joy. A little later on perhaps a subsequent retreat, Bhante said in reference to the mindfulness of breathing, this practice, he said, can take you quite a long way along the spiritual path. I remember that. I've always loved the mindfulness of breathing. It has been, over the years, in a way, it's been my favourite practice. But it's not just the mindfulness of breathing I want to speak about in reference to Bhante. I want to talk about Bhante's mindfulness in general. And I came across the other day a saying by the American writer Emerson. And he says, the hero is the man who is immovably centered. The hero is the man who is immovably centered. I thought of Akshobhya, the Buddha, Akshobhya. And I thought of Bhante, and Bhante in his mindfulness. And that was one aspect of Bhante that really had a very strong effect on me in the late 1960s, 1970s. And this heroic quality of mindfulness is echoed in the Dhammapada. I don't know the exact quote, but it says something like, the man who conquers himself and the man who conquers his own roving, even raving mind, that is the greatest conquest. And Bhante used to wear, on certain occasions, he used to wear his mindfulness like armour. I remember vividly once going with him to Sakura, which is the name of the very first small centre of the Friends of the Western Sangha at the time, and we travelled from his flat in Highgate West Hill to Sakura, which was Leicester Square, which is on the northern line, and we got the tube on the northern line from Kentish Town. And Bhante rests, I think this was winter, actually, dressed in his robes, and over his robes a dark maroon cloak. And we go, close the front door of his flat, and start this journey. And immediately I felt, as we close, I don't want to exaggerate it, but it was like this, close the front door, and I almost sensed him ratcheting up the level of mindfulness. Really sort of, you know, please don't talk. He didn't say it, but it was like, please don't talk to me. We have to be very careful. We have to be very mindful now. And on the tube, he was so sort of mindful that, you know how you can get so distracted on the underground with the adverts, the people sitting opposite you, maybe attractive man or attractive woman, and, you know, before you know where it's all hanging out. He was very sort of alert to the possibility of the demons. It was as strong as that. And he did this, of course, in order to remain centered. He was going to teach the Dharma. He was going to give a class, a meditation class. I'm always mindful, he said to me once. I can't remember what we were talking about. Possibly about something which could have been potentially quite distracting. But he said to me, I'm always mindful. I want to make a, before I leave this section on mindfulness, I want to make a connection between mindfulness and joy. I was walking down the street with him in Highgate Village. He just bought some salad to make for our lunch, and we were walking along the street, and he said, these days I feel quite ecstatic. I thought, wow, you lucky man. But I was very impressed at the same time. He said, yes, I feel really blissful and ecstatic. And he said, with some luck, it will become permanent. Well, again, I thought, wow. I made the connection between, I made the connection with the spiral path, not at the time, because I didn't really know about the spiral path, but I'm making it now because I think it's relevant. In dependence upon bliss arises concentration. Yeah. So if you're experiencing ecstasy, bliss, all the time, you're going to get concentrated within a snap of a finger. And in dependence on concentration arises knowledge and vision of things as they really are. So what a wonderful state of mind to be in when you're founding a new Buddhist movement. Okay, so I'm going to move now on to spiritual friendship, Kalyanamitrita. Vertical and horizontal. So in my early friendship with Bhante, I related to him as time went on, both as a spiritual teacher and as a man, another man, like myself. And on one occasion, and this relates to the vertical rather than the horizontal, one occasion we got into a pretty good level of communication. And he said to me, I hope you don't feel overwhelmed. Well, I did, but I said I didn't. I hope you don't feel overwhelmed. That was, you know, the much more highly developed spiritual being speaking to the being of lower spiritual development. It can be quite frightening. It can be quite overwhelming, as you know. And then later on in the same conversation came the affirmation. He said, I can feel your being quite strongly. I can feel your being quite strongly. And this came as a sort of very pleasant shock to me, because it was an affirmation. He was the spiritual, this is the way I interpret it, the Kalyana Mitra, the spiritual friend, is saying to his friend who is on a lower level, you have great spiritual potential, and I can see that, I can feel it. You're on the, as it were, on the verge of moving into a higher state of being. So that was quite wonderful moment for me, and I'm sure we've all experienced that in this room. We've all experienced it, surely, either from an order member to a mitra, or an order member to a friend, or an order member to an order member. And I'm not saying that necessarily it's someone of a high, who's permanently, so to speak, on a higher spiritual level. It could be in the course of a conversation where an order member says to you, or an order member says to another order member, something which is vitally important and which actually, to some extent, releases you and inspires you to take a step further. This is a very wonderful aspect of Kalyana Mitrata. So that's vertical I've been talking about. But Bhante also said to me in those days, he said, I don't want you to relate to me as a guru. I don't want you to put me on a pedestal up there. I want you to relate to me as another human being. That's horizontal. In those days, not quite then, but later on, a text became very famous, not the right word, very popular for study in the movement. And that was a chapter in the Jewel Ornament of Liberation called Meeting Spiritual Friends. And when I was making my notes, I was going to say to you, unfortunately, this text seems to be no longer practiced or no longer studied these days. And then just before I came in here this morning, I saw on the notice board there's going to be a retreat in July led by Padma Vajra on that chapter, Meeting Spiritual Friends. Anyway, it says in the course of this chapter, and I'll read this quote to you. At the beginning of one's career, when we are still imprisoned by our deeds and emotions, we will have to seek an ordinary human being who can illumine the path we have to follow. The greatest benefactor is a spiritual friend in the form of an ordinary human being. So I did try my best to relate to Bhante as an ordinary human being, and I did quite successfully. I could see his weaknesses as an ordinary human being. But the two, the guru, the archetypal guru, if you like, and the ordinary human being, it's very easy to confuse the two. I'll just give you a very naive example from my own experience. I had a car at the time, and Stephen, who was to become Ananda the following year, he invited us to supper. And Ananda lived at the other end of London. So we had to drive from Bhante's flat to the other end of London. And I hadn't a clue where Stephen's flat was. But Bhante had an idea. And I sort of said to myself, well, it's all going to be absolutely fine because Bhante will just lead us there. So we're driving along and he said, I think we turn left here. She turned left here. It's a cul-de-sac. Long. There we go. 10 minutes later, oh, maybe we go right here, you know. Then we get absolutely lost. Oh, maybe that wasn't right, you know. And it took us ages and ages to get to Stephen's place. So my belief in Bhante's omniscience was absolutely shattered on that journey. So what helped to cement the friendship between Bhante and me at the time was our shared interest in literature. He loved literature. I loved literature. So we had that in common. So as you know, it's always very, very good in spiritual friendship to have something in common which you can share. It sort of lubricates the relationship. And he knew so much about literature. I'd read English literature at university, but he knew far more than I did. He was a voracious reader, and his flat was lined with books. Most of the rooms in that little flat were lined with books, and it appeared, listening to him, that he read most of them. And in 1979, when I was living here, I lived here in 1979, and Mahamati was living here at the same time. And I went to Bhante's room and said to him that I was thinking of doing a lecture at a convention, a lecture on the subject of Buddhism and John Keats. Yeah, John Keats being a famous romantic poet. And I suppose part of me was expecting Bhante to say, maybe that's, you know, perhaps we ought to stick to traditional Dharma. But immediately he said, oh, good. And he went to his bookshelves and drew out three or four books about Keats, ammunition for my talk, you know, which was great. But just before I finish, on Kalyanamitrata, I'll just mention that Bhante really, really emphasized the importance of horizontal Kalyanamitrata in the early days. The vertical was obvious. There were no order members, there was just him. So everybody looked up to him, like a sort of very, very sort of steep pyramid, you know, all of us down at the bottom and Bhante up there. And he said, no, no, no. He says, you've got to develop friendships with one another. And that was so difficult in those days. I'm not saying it's easy these days. It's not easy, is it? But it wouldn't have crossed our minds. And he saw how vitally important that was, that we develop friendships with one another. And we go to one another with our problems, with our difficulties, and with our inspirations. And we share them that way. We don't sort of, as it were, ignore each other and then just talk to the spiritual teacher. I'm not saying that there weren't friendships between us in those days. There were. But there's a tendency to go vertical and to avoid the horizontal. But he persisted, he kept on and on and on about it. So we did it. And it was difficult. It was really difficult. But it was so important. And what it's led to over the years is that the wonderful network of spiritual friendships that we've got in the movement today. It's unique, I think. I remember Parami, who is the order convener for women. She goes to a lot of these meetings, not interfaith meetings, but meetings between Buddhist groups. And she said, this is a few years ago now, she said she's heard more than once people say to her, "Ah, the FWBO are so good at Sangha." And I think this is a wonderful compliment. Yeah? The FWBO are so good at Sangha. The development of Kalyana Mitrata between order members, mitras and friends is so impressive to those outside as well as inside. And I think this is a stroke of Bhante's spiritual genius. I've always thought this, that he should see and bring out the importance of horizontal spiritual friendship, Kalyana Mitrata. It's not there in the scriptures much, but he's brought it out as he's brought out other things. The great spiritual teacher makes explicit what is implicit. And that's something that Bhante has a genius for, making explicit what is implicit, being able to draw out something of great importance, which when you read a text isn't immediately by any means clear to you. This is partly Bhante as a translator, isn't it? Okay, so I'm going to conclude now, and I want to conclude with a transitional moment. Now it's 1972 or 1973. I've got to know Bhante very well. I've visited him a lot. He's visited us a lot. And by this time, in 1972, 1973, we, that is my wife and I, with other friends, were all living in Cornwall in a sort of family community set up. And I invite Bhante to come and see us. And the week before, he rings me up. He asks me, he writes to me and asks me to ring him. So I go to the public telephone box. No mobile phones in those days. I go to the telephone box and wait for him to ring, pick it up. And he says in that short phone conversation, he says, "Be prepared for a shock when you meet me." I said, "Oh, God, oh, okay, what the heck's that?" So, of course, that gets me really excited and, well, I wonder what it is. So, on the day, I drive the car to Plymouth Station and I go on the requisite platform and the doors are opening. I go right down and one of the doors opens and there's Bhante standing in the doorway, dressed in a pale pink T-shirt and purple trousers. I mean, Bhante always wore robes in those days on ceremonial occasions, and any public occasion, whenever you saw him, he was always in his long flowing robes, a bit like the book, certainly like he is in that picture on the left there, just like that, always. So be prepared for a shock. So he flings the door open. He's got this wide, toothy grin, you know. He said, "What do you think?" And I thought, "You look much reduced." I really thought that. I didn't say it, but he did. He's just a very thin, slight man, not young. He's in his mid-40s by now, wearing this not very attractive gear, actually. But there he was, still breaking through, yeah? Breaking through conventions, yeah? What would the chairman of the Buddhist Society have said? You know, smashes through it, showing that genuine spiritual life has nothing to do with what he called conventional morality or social custom. I've got to break through all that. So by this time, at this transitional moment, one-to-one contact with Bante, which for the first 8-9 years had been possible, was no longer as easy. It was becoming less and less possible to spend a lot of time with Bante one-to-one because the movement was expanding. So in a sense, that meeting on Plymouth Station signifies a sort of ending of a phase and beginning of another for me. And in 1974, the summer of 1974, I asked Bante for ordination at last. I asked him for ordination. And I suppose I expected him to say, "Oh, great, I'm so pleased to hear that." He didn't. He said, "Oh, we must fix a date then." And a few weeks later, I got a postcard saying, "You will be ordained at Broomhouse Farm with Tony Matthews." Tony Matthews would become Kamala Sheila, and three or four other people who became ordained. So I was ordained in November of 1974. And on that note, I finish my little talk.